A mother's been found guilty of murdering her 42-day-old baby by poisoning her with a powerful painkiller. 34-year-old Michelle Smith broke down as the verdict was delivered at Swansea Crown Court. A criminal investigation has been launched into the rigging of interbank lending rates, which could see bankers facing court. The Serious Fraud Office will lead the inquiry after Barclays was fined nearly £300 million last week. The Chief Secretary to the Treasury, Danny Alexander, welcomes the move.
This brings the possibility of criminal prosecutions for these terrible events in the banking sector. And of course, as a government, we will make sure that the Serious Fraud Office has all the resources it needs to conduct this investigation to the full.
Anti-terrorism police have arrested seven men after a number of weapons were found during a routine stop and search. A car was pulled over on the M1 on Saturday and the driver found not to be insured. A woman's admitted using a brick to smash a window at Simon Cowell's house. Leanne Zalamis was told not to contact Cowell or go within 300 metres of his London home. Large parts of England and Wales are braced for further flooding as a month's rains expected to fall in 24 hours. The Met Office has issued 39 flood warnings and nearly 130 alerts. That's the latest. I'm Kat Collins.
BCFM 93.2 is a charity and works with the diverse communities in Bristol. So please continue to support us by getting involved and spreading the word.
Hello Bristol and welcome to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling and helping us review this week's news, although he's stuck in traffic at the moment, is National Vice President of the Public and Commercial Services Union, the PCS, John McAnally. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. In the second hour, after six, after his insight a few weeks ago into Who Owns Britain, author of the book of the same name and Sunday Times Rich List journalist Kevin Cahill spreads his wings further this week as we ask the question in the title of his more recent book, Who Owns the World? We take a look at the massive farm subsidies to the already rich and powerful landowners, and David Powell from Friends of the Earth is here to talk about land grabbing, commodities, population and China. Plus, polonium, Paraguay and the Straits of Hormuz feature in Martin Summers' weekly roundup of world events. That's in the second hour after the 6 o'clock news. On to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 12 Celsius and wet, as you might have guessed. This weekend, highs of 17, some sunny spells, but plenty of showers on Saturday and Sunday. I don't know quite what plenty of showers means, quite a lot. We've had enough already, haven't we? Next week, highs of 20 degrees Celsius, a little warmer, wetter at the beginning of the week, sunnier towards the end of the week. Next weekend, 14th and 15th of July, highs of 16 Celsius, less wet, fairly cloudy. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Time to introduce this week's guest, and we're still waiting for John McAnally, but Martin Summers is here. Martin, the Vickers report, which we've been hearing quite a bit about this week, is not going to be implemented, that is splitting off the casino investment banking from our high street banking, until 2018. And there's also there are calls to sort of bring that forward. Why is it being left such a long time to, until 2018 to actually carry that out?
Well, basically, it should never. The casino banks should never have been part of the mainstream retail banking system at all. And all it's all very well talking about separating them either now or in the future, but I'm afraid the damage is done. The casino banks have wrecked the economy, and talking about how we might manage things in the future is really rather by the by. People just don't seem to realise how serious the situation is. And all of this talk about reform of the banks, it's too late. It's just too late.
So, what's the light at the end of the tunnel? What would you do in this situation? If you say, you can't just say it's too late because we need a banking sector. We can't just survive without banks, can we?
What should have happened in 2008 when the banks went down was that the governments, if they were going to move in on the banks, should have moved in and dismantled them, basically. They haven't dismantled them. They've propped them up and they've carried on doing what they carry on doing, which
is basically
looting.
Wouldn't it have been enough at that time to actually separate the investment banks from the high street banks at that point?
Well, the problem is that the investment banks have corrupted the retail banking sector, and separating them in the future doesn't solve the problem. It's like the damage is done.
So where is all the wealth gone that should be in our healthy bank accounts, lots of interest?
The way things are working is. This is actually working out like a massive control fraud. Those people who are working in the city are basically looting what's left of the economy, and it's like a parasite killing its own host. You can have a bit of financial speculation in any economy, and a strong economy can take it, but we've reached the point now where the financial speculators are basically killing off the real economy, and sooner or later they're going to crash. And when they do, there's going to be a huge social upheaval all over the world. I mean,
where's all this wealth been going to then? Or is it gone already? Well, is it in these banks? Because you keep saying the banks are bust. That implies that the current banks, the high street names that we know, their investment arms too, are bust. Yeah. And that implies that someone somewhere has got this money. Or is it just debt?
No, but what you've got there is a financial oligarchy which has snaffled up the assets of the society. Right across the globe, and the fire insurance and real estate sector, the so-called fire sector, has basically captured all the income streams. Manufacturing and service industries have been completely squeezed out, and people think that there has been a crash, but there hasn't. There's going to be a crash. We haven't had it yet, and when it comes, it's going to make 1929 look like a walk in the park.
So are you saying that as part of this crisis over the last probably 20, 30 years, that slowly but surely ownership of many of our assets has actually changed hands? And if so, from who to who?
Well, look at the example of Greece. They are being told by the Troika that they've got to carry out austerity policies, and one of the main things they will have to do is sell off all the public assets, like public land and things of that sort. But of course it's a fire sale, so they won't get the proper price for it. And of course what will happen is private companies, financial companies based in the financial centres of Wall Street and the City of London, will get basically Greece's assets for a fraction of what they're really worth. This is robbery. That's the only thing you can call it.
So do you take any solace from the fact that the Serious Fraud Office has today announced its investigation into the LIBOR scandal? Because the big numbers are involved there, weren't they?
Yes. Well, I mean, it's beyond belief, isn't it? The LIBOR rate is the key rate on all financial transactions right across the globe, and they were trying to defend it by saying, "Oh, well, we needed to massage it down in order to encourage the economy to not to collapse." But of course, they were fiddling the rate even before 2008, so they've been fiddling these rates for years. And what we're seeing here is arrogance and hubris beyond belief. I mean, Bob Dimon was even talking about, the new ethical banking the week before all this stuff came out. And, we ought to be prosecuting people at the top, and we ought to be sending them to prison, or that's one of the things we need to do. But sadly, they have, in fact, trashed the economy. And, what we really need to do is cancel the derivatives market, dismantle the banks, and begin a program of massive public investments to put people back to work. But that's not going to happen until the political power of the financial oligarchy has been completely broken.
Okay, so do you think that that's going to happen? Is there anything on the horizon that suggests that the political power of the banks, because we don't really think of them as politically powerful, but I noticed today, for example, John McDonnell had a bill going through, a private members' bill going through in the House of Commons was being discussed, which he wants to go through, which is to give the House of Commons oversight of the appointment of governors of the Bank of England. Now, I thought that the House of Commons did have some kind of oversight of that, but apparently not.
Well, I mean,
but that's been filibustered, you see.
Yes, so, well, also, of course, it was Gordon Brown who made the Bank of England independent of the government, and that's another part of the neoliberal mantra that the bank should be independent of the government. And of course, for many years the Bank of England wasn't independent of the government, so they could use the Bank of England to try and steer the economy.
But isn't there a lot of blame changing going on here? The government blaming the banking sector, and the banking sector blaming the government.
Well, I mean, what's happening politically is that George Osborne, with absolute chutzpah, is claiming that it's all Labour's fault because they didn't regulate properly when they were in power. Now, that is correct, but at that very time, George Osborne and David Cameron were calling for less regulation of the city. And if the Labour Party had tried to regulate the city, they would have screamed and shouted and carried on.
Yeah, but they could have done, couldn't they? Because they were in power.
They should have done. In 1997, when Labour came back to power, they should have gone straight into the City of London and closed down a lot of the casino operations.
But they didn't. Wouldn't the sort of Bob Diamonds of the time have then said to them, like they've said to the Bank of England now, you dare and we will release information to the public?
Well, the problem was that the Labour Party as a whole decided that it was going to make its peace with the City of London when John Smith went on the so-called prawn cocktail offensive in the early 90s. And that was the point at which Brian Gould resigned as deputy leader of the Labour Party and went back to New Zealand, because he said, unless you're prepared to take on the City of London, we're all wasting our time. And if you're going to take the City of London on, the Labour leadership has to spell that out to the people before an election so that the people know what they're up against, because the city will fight hard, and therefore you've got to have a load of momentum if you're going to take them on.
Now, John McInerney from PCS has just arrived, and while he's settling down, making his chair comfortable, we'll have a bit of music from Attila the Stockbroker.
Dazza is a looter in trainers and a hood. He trashed his local corner shop. He'd learned that greed is good. The CCTV nailed him. The papers called him scum. Now Dazza's in the barry place, crying for his mum. There's no such thing as society, so steal and cheat and loot. Just one thing to remember, make sure you wear a suit. Is a looter in pinstripes, brogues and tie. Short selling in the city, he made millions on the sly. He nicked our hard-earned savings, then turned round and said thanks. He walked off with the money and we bailed out the banks. There's no such thing as society, so steal and cheat and loot. Just one thing to remember, make sure you wear a suit. Greed to creed that breeds and breeds, what else can you expect? The selfish scum get richer and communities get wrecked. Some rob us with an iron bar, some a computer screen. And when they say it's legal, that's even more obscene. Dazza is a street kid, and what he did was wrong. But he probably wouldn't do it if he felt he could belong. Bazza's rich and privileged, he doesn't give a shit. He takes us for a load of mugs and gets away with it. There's no such thing as society, so steal and cheat and loot. Just one thing to remember, make sure you wear a suit. There's no such thing as society, so steal and cheat and loot. Just one thing to remember, make sure you wear a suit. Make sure you wear a suit. Make sure you wear a suit.
Attila the Stockbroker there with a quite a topical song about called Looters. Now I'm joined by John McInerney from PCS, the Public and Commercial Services Union. Hi John, welcome to Drive Time. Hi. And you have your union's come out with an announcement this week, hasn't it? I noticed about the potential, anyway, funding of candidates at the next general election. Can you just tell us about the process that the union's gone through to reach that decision?
Well, we've decided to, and by a ballot, overwhelmingly members, they voted in certain circumstances to fund or support candidates in national elections. That would be parliamentary elections or elections in the devolved assemblies. The process has really been, as you know, we've been facing a cuts and privatisation attack, not just under this government, for the past 10, 12 years, under the previous government as well. And of course, we fight industrially, we take strike action, we run campaigns and so on, but it's absolutely clear that if you win anything or you're trying to stop something, if it's not underpinned by the political process, the employer will just wait and come back and try to get you again and take away what it is you're trying to defend. So We came to the conclusion in discussions with members and activists that we had to do more. We set up something called the Make Your Vote Count campaign, which was really to try and engage with politicians. But surprise, surprise, politicians didn't always tell the truth. And when they got into Parliament, they didn't always speak quite as radically as they did when they were being asked by our members whether or not they would oppose cuts. Look, the bottom line here is that as a political consensus in this country amongst all the major political parties, there's no alternative to cuts. And we're in a situation where, I mean, PCS is not a political party, it's a trade union, but in certain circumstances, say for example there is a by-election, there's a hospital or government buildings closing, and there's a campaign on the ground. And if none of the candidates were supporting public services, all were in favour of cuts, surely it's a simple logical step to aid with our campaign and work to stand or support a candidate who's talking out, articulating our views that these cuts are a disaster. That's really the idea behind it.
But John, there's already an existing political party, it's called the Labour Party. Surely if you fund MPs for the Labour Party and you help fund the Labour Party, they can adopt this position, and they're already, you know, hundreds of Labour MPs in Parliament. So why try and start something new when there's something already existing there?
Well, first of all, PCS is not affiliated to the Labour Party. So from that point of view, you know, we're an independent trade union. Our first loyalty is to our members. But by the way, look, I was a member of the Labour Party for over 20 years. Haven't been for a long, long time. But the brutal reality is that the Labour Party supports the cuts, the Labour Party supports privatisation, and we have a really serious situation in this country. There are no mainstream politicians talking out in favour of ordinary people. And when I say ordinary people, I don't just mean the workers, I mean the middle classes as well. If you look at what happened in Parliament this week, that disgusting shambles in terms of the banks, what we're dealing with is an unaccountable elite who have the politicians in their pockets. Now, let me just make this point about the Labour Party. We've got lots of very good activists in the Labour Party, and a lot of them tell me they're going to stay in the Labour Party to try and transform it back into the party that set up the National Health Service. We wish you the best of luck. I say that without irony. Good luck to you. But it doesn't look, from where I'm sitting, and certainly from where our members are sitting, that that's going to happen anytime soon.
But couldn't you wave a few pound notes underneath Ed Miliband's nose and say to him, well, look, come on, Ed, we can help fund your party. You're always having difficulty raising money. Why not think twice about the pro-cuts policy?
Well, certainly couldn't wave as much money under his nose as multinational corporations do. So, I mean, from that point of view, I'm not sure we would be in the same league there. Look, it's not about, I mean, whatever I feel about Ed Miliband, I don't think he's so in principle it's just about waving money under his nose. He doesn't see any alternative to the cuts. His formulation, Ed Balls' formulation, is there should be cuts but only slower and less steep. I'm not quite sure what that means. If you look at the statistics, their statistics, not ours, that they want to implement in financial terms as many cuts as the Tories, just want to do it over a longer period of time. But I think this country and internationally, we're in a real crisis now. It's absolutely clear austerity isn't working. They are not listening to logic. So maybe we have to do, in limited circumstances, because as I say, we don't have the ability to stand in every constituency, but the reality is that if we are to represent our members properly, that means represent them on the political field as well. And if we're going to try and influence the politicians, maybe they need to face a challenge at election time as well.
Well, on the left, we've already got the Green Party, we've already got the Respect Party. You know, for your candidates, aren't you essentially just going to split the left vote even more? Actually, maybe play into the hands of the right, of the Conservatives, possibly.
It's a fair question, but we are not a political party like the Greens. Can I just say, in terms of the Greens, I've got a lot of respect for the Greens, but when the Greens have been in power, not in power, but certainly in government, rather, to be more precise, and other countries, whether it be Ireland or Germany, they haven't always been as radical as they should be. I spoke at a Green Party conference fringe meeting last year. I made precisely that point. There has to be consistency, and it did get a good reception. I think there's a lot of people in the Green Party understand that. No, as far as we are concerned, we would never stand a candidate where it would split the vote in terms of, say, a far-right candidate. But, you know, in terms of the general policies, I understand that the Conservatives are more vicious than Labour, but they still believe in the cuts. So from that point of view, we're not setting up an alternative party. What we would do on a democratic basis is work with local anti-cuts campaigners. It would have to be campaigns rooted in the community. We wouldn't just come in from London, if you like, and say, right, we're going to run a candidate here, which some people do, actually. So we are quite clear this helps our campaign and work, and it articulates the need for a decent welfare state, for good public services and some decency in this country before it gets too bad.
Martin Summers, you're a Labour Party member, in a way doing what I suppose John was saying there. You're fighting for an anti-cuts policy, essentially, within the Labour Party. Can you understand, though, why he's kind of feeling a little bit like he's been tearing his hair out, and that it's going that his particular union is going to have to just go and pick and choose candidates, find anti-cuts candidates, and help them rather than the party as a whole?
Well, I mean, I understand. I mean, if we had a proper electoral system, like, you know, as in an Ireland or somewhere like that, then this wouldn't be a problem.
But we have to deal with what we've got.
We do have to deal with what we've got, and that's the only note of caution I would bring in here. What we really need to develop, in my view, is the kind of thing that used to go on in the six counties in Northern Ireland for many years, which is that there was real political discipline on both sides, so you ended up with just one candidate representing each community by the time it came. It was a first-past-the-post system, so when Bobby Sands was elected, for example, the SDLP stood down to give him a free run. And I would like to see a situation where we develop a coalition of the left where, for example, where the Greens are strong, we won't stand against them, and vice versa. And that could include, you know, Respect candidates or possibly, you know, PCS candidates.
But isn't that almost impossible? You've always got this people's front of Judea. That's just wishful thinking. The people's front of Judea syndrome, isn't it, really?
Well, we've got to get away from that, actually. What we really need to do is recognise that there are various strands of progressive thinking in the country from different traditions, and we actually need to unite together as best we can in order to resist the attacks that are being made on ourselves, on our class. And I think the problem is that people are not very politically sophisticated, and they don't understand how to build alliances. I mean, within the Labour Party, if I was to suggest that we wouldn't stand against other candidates who are a left persuasion, that would, you know, there would be complete horror, because the Labour Party's policy is to stand candidates in every constituency and for everything. And, you know, I think it's pretty damn silly to stand people against George Galloway in Bradford. I mean, he's dug in there now, and you know, you might as well. You know, if we had a proper electoral system, there wouldn't be a problem. But the Tories are going to try and gerrymander the system to make it even worse. And unless we show some discipline, it's likely that we're going to be walked all over.
Okay, now let's go to what John McNally was talking about. At least I assume that this is what it was. The Treasury Select Committee meeting this week, where we had Bob Diamond facing questions from MPs. And this is John Mann putting some points to him.
You must have been grossly incompetent in your job during that period of time if you weren't complicit in this.
So, is there a question?
Undeterred, Mr. Mann pressed on. He wanted Mr. Diamond to make a suggestion.
Of how you can show some contrition to those Barclays staff across the country and the customers who are wondering and emailing me in vast numbers saying, what do I do with my money? Do I take it out of this rotten, thieving bank? That's what they're asking me. So, I'm asking you, what are you going to do to put the record straight with your personal behaviour? Because you personally are responsible, either by being complicit or by being incompetent.
Mr. Diamond didn't respond to that, and Mr. Mann sought to help him.
You know, your bonus each year is equivalent to the amount of money that our largest homelessness charity shelter has to survive on. That's how much bonus you were getting in every one of these three rotten years, and all the others alongside you. Why don't you make a proper gesture and put some serious money and persuade your colleagues to do likewise, so that you can show to the outside world that you do mean business by saying that you're apologising, and persuade your colleagues, those who've left and those still in there, to do likewise. Then you might get a little love.
I told you I feel I've done the responsible thing in how we've handled this since the day we understood.
That was Bob Dimond answering questions from the Labour MP John Mann for Bassett Law up north. Now, John McAnally, what do you think of what you heard there? Was that what you were referring to earlier on as a farcical situation up in London?
I was in part referring to that. I haven't actually seen the whole of that committee. But the point I made to somebody just the other day, that there was great outrage in the press and the political class that they were doing this. Well, I always assumed they were doing it anyway. It simply didn't surprise me. What we have is a situation, and I don't want to sound too extreme here in the way I pose this, but it's an unaccountable elite. The bankers, big corporations, who've got the politicians in their pocket, and they have been running wild for the past two decades, unregulated, and you know, this phony outrage. I mean, I'm sure Mr. Mann was doing a good job. I don't know him. He sounded very good there in terms of the questioning, but come on, everybody knew. Everybody knows they're a bunch of crooks. They're putting people in jail for stealing a bottle of water during the riots, and Bob Dimond gets £20 million. I couldn't say any other what I think should be done to them.
Well, we've here tonight, this is 5 o'clock on the BBC website, that a serious fraud office is launching a LIBOR investigation. Do you think that's enough?
Well, I think criminality is running rife in this country, corporate criminality, and amongst politicians as well. And is it enough? Well, I hope the Serious Fraud Office does pursue this, and I do hope there are not only convictions, but I hope people are put in prison as a result of it. But no, it's not enough. It's about a culture of entitlement. These people are carrying out at the present time a hate campaign against the poorest people in society, the disabled, the vulnerable people on benefits, and they're filling their boots. And that is why we need political voices speaking out against them, articulating what real people feel.
Okay, now, we had a bit of a treat on BBC Radio Bristol this week. John Darbell, who does their morning show, interviewed one of our local big investment bankers. That's Peter Hargreaves, one of the founders of Hargreaves Lansdowne. So let's have a little listen to what Peter Hargreaves has to say, and then I'll ask my guests to comment on what they think of him.
My question this morning, do you want to see bankers behind bars? Let's speak to Peter Hargreaves, who's the co-founder of the financial services company Hargreaves Lansdowne, who are a big success story here in Bristol. Peter, good morning to you.
Good morning. It's a very complex subject, this, and we don't really know how many people were complicit. Were they fiddling interest rates? Not really. Interest rates are interest rates. You lend at the highest rate as you possibly can get, and you borrow at the lowest rate you can get. What they were actually doing is they were reporting the amount that they were lending at or borrowing at lower than the amount they were really doing it. Mm. There was a reason they did that. They did it because everyone was worried about the bank that had to pay the highest rate of interest, because clearly the one that was paying the highest rate of interest was one that was perceived to be the most risky and most likely to fail. But all the banks were doing it. I'm pretty sure. And the government knew about it at the time. Mm. We actually wonder whether the regulator should have known about it. If the regulator didn't know about it, the regulator was incompetent. So I think the regulator knew about it as well. Where the fraudulence may be, where the worry is, that then, despite the fact that interest rates were higher than those reported, they were taking those interest rates and making complex investment products. They were using things which most people don't understand.
But we're all paying for.
well, to some extent. Yeah. And those products were linked to the reported rates of LIBOR, which weren't really the rates of LIBOR. I'm not sure the banks are totally to blame. They've been taking the blame because the government at the time was happy for the banks to take the blame. But it was a binge of borrowing that caused the problem, a binge of borrowing. And the people that were borrowing the most at the time were the government in power. They were binging on borrowing and putting money into the public sector, which was squandered. And that was as big a problem as the banks. So the banks aren't just the only people to blame. It's the borrowing binge of the late noughties that caused the problem.
Well, that's our local big hitter, and his name is Peter Hargreaves, builder of all the big buildings around town, it seems. Martin Summers, he's saying they're basically blaming a lot of this on the borrowing binge by your new Labour government, essentially by Gordon Brown and people like that.
Well, it's just trying to divert attention. The
but they were borrowing, though, weren't they? They did have a borrowing binge.
There may have been some fiscal slippage, but the real problem we face is the banking sector. Mr. Hargreaves there, if the state hadn't stepped in to bail out the sector, Hargreaves Lansdowne would be bankrupt, and he wouldn't be sitting there being a big success story. He'd be a bankrupt. And this is what he doesn't seem to understand, and they're not willing to understand. If we had allowed the system to play out, a free market policy would have allowed the banks to go down, and that would have crashed Hargreaves Lansdowne and all the rest of them, and they would all be bust. But we didn't do that. We bailed them out. And not only did we bail them out, we still have to listen to this nonsense of them telling us about what we can and can't do.
But he's saying they weren't really fiddling the interest rates at all. He was saying they were just reporting a lower rate.
Oh, yes, it wasn't really. The point is that in actual fact, and this is going to hit really hard, in the US, various trusts and funds are going to sue. They're going to sue the British banks for fiddling LIBOR, and they're going to get billions off them. In other words, if they weren't bankrupt before, they will definitely be bankrupt after that. And what we're going to see, possibly as a result of this, is the complete unravelling of the banking system, a complete crash, and then Hargreaves Lansdowne will go down with all the rest of them. And that's what will probably happen.
Now, John McAnally from the Public and Commercial Services Union, what he's telling us there, essentially, I mean, he told us a lot of things, but one of them was that all the banks have been doing it, all of them.
Well, that's what I said just a few minutes ago. I mean, I was not surprised when I heard about the LIBOR rate being fiddled. But I think there's an interesting point in this. There's been a propaganda campaign, an ideological campaign of, you know, unprecedented ferocity over the last number of years to say that the big problem in society is the public sector. You know, it costs too much, it's unaffordable, pensions are unaffordable, etc., etc. It's absolutely clear, looking at the way that the banks have behaved, that the real problem lies in the banking system. It lies, if you like, in the market, in the unregulated market. So there's nothing this surprises me. I'll tell you what, I think there's more to come, not just in terms of the banks in Britain, but internationally. It's absolutely clear, I think, that if you don't control things, that they're going to really spin out of control, and I think that's what's happened here, and that's why I think that we have to seriously talk about nationalising the banks.
Martin Summers is quite often talking about the banks as utilities. I quite like this idea, the idea that there are certain basic services in society which the government takes direct responsibility for. Is there something you'd be in favour of, turning the banks into a kind of public utility?
Well, that's our union policy, actually. I would just describe it as unions. I would just describe it as common sense. The banks can't be allowed to fail, but nor can society.
One of the things we've heard about recently as well is this week, unemployment figures out for the European Union. Pretty horrific. We're talking about jobless rate for the Eurozone climbing up to 11.1%, the highest level since the creation of the Euro. Youth unemployment has risen to 22.6% this week, with 52% and of the under 25s in both Greece and Spain without work. That's over half now of youngsters in Greece and Spain out of work. I mean, where is this all leading if we don't have some pretty quick changes soon? Because this is really concerns me. If you've got all our young people, older people being told they've got to keep working, young people not being in work, and an overall interest rate the highest since the euro was created, we're not going anywhere in any positive direction right now, are we?
Well, I won't take up your time telling you what the possible social consequences are of that rate of youth unemployment and unemployment generally. You know, you'd have to be very dim not to understand that. But the reality is that we have said that there is an alternative to this chaos. And it's not, as some people in the government or the Labour Party try to claim, some kind of radical socialist alternative. It is simple Keynesianism from that point of view. And that'd be invest in jobs, invest in growth, invest in the public sector, make people pay their taxes who try to avoid it. You know, it's absolutely scandalous that, we all pay our taxes, but rich people don't. Even if you'd done that without having a socialist revolution, you could begin to make things a little bit better. But what we're dealing with is greed on an unparalleled level. that the Camerons and the Bob Dimes in this world really believe that they're the masters of the universe and they owe nothing to anybody other than filling their pockets with loot. That's why we're in the situation we're in.
Well, I'm reminded of that expression that the criminals don't rob the banks anymore. They own them.
Yeah.
Anyway, we've got another story now from Marina Roris about child sexual exploitation in children's homes this week. Over to you, Marina.
Hello. The Office of the Children's Commission, yes, has published a report on the emerging findings of an inquiry into child sexual exploitation, in particular in children's homes. Statistics published by CAFCAS, the Children and Family Court Advisory and Support Service, show an increasing trend and all-time record number of applications to take children into state care. About 3/4 of these children will be cared by the foster cares, but an increasing shortage of foster carers means that it is becoming increasingly likely that more children will end up in children's care homes. When they leave children's homes age 18, they are more likely than general population to become homeless or end up in prison. The review led by Sue Barilowitz, the Deputy Children's Commissioner, warns that children in care homes are being subjected to sexual abuse of a violent and sadistic nature, and that most victims are female. Tim Lawton, the Children's Minister, talks of heat maps in his Kent constituency showing the location of children in care and known sex offenders, often in the same street. Children's care homes are typically located in low-cost housing areas to save money. The same economic forces influence the location of halfway houses for sex offenders after they leave prison. About 45% of children in care live outside the boundaries of the local authority responsible for their care. Shipped into a region where sex offenders are known to live, perhaps hundreds of miles away from support from family and friends. This is often to distance them from past abusers. Police figures show an estimate 10,000 children go missing from care each year, whilst official government data records only 930 children disappearing. Police and local authorities can't share information about where children's homes are. If you want to know, ask a sex offender. According to the Children's Minister, £1 billion a year is being spent on 5,000 children in care, an average £200,000 a year per child. One company, Castle Care, owned by a private company, Baird Capital, shared charged a council £378,000 for one child in 2009. Meanwhile, at the other end of the scale, the minimum fostering allowance paid for a baby age 0 to 4, £125 per week. You don't do this for the money. The National Probation Service tasks these overseeing sex offenders after release for prison is faced these cuts. So is the prison service, which provides sex offender treatment program to sex offenders while they are in prison. So are the police and social services. Meanwhile, private provision of foster placement at private children's homes is a big and growing business. More and more children are being taken in the state care. They are already failing public services that are supposed to protect them and facing further cuts. There are often not sexual forms of exploitation not mentioned. Who cares about the safety, welfare and emotional development of very vulnerable children? Meanwhile, a cycle for some of victims who become abusers and if caught, an expensive prison cells awaits. Private businesses is making money, public services in child welfare. Who cares?
Thanks very much, Marina. John, I'll just bring you in on this because, I mean, some pretty shocking figures there, talking about 10,000 children going missing from care each year, although official government data only records 930 of them. One does wonder about that. But I suppose the main point that Marina's making in that report is this whole business of, economic determinism. A lot of this does come back down to money, which is driving sex offenders into the same areas, accommodation to the same areas as children's homes. This seems completely crazy.
Well, when Marina was speaking, I was putting down a few notes. The first one I put down was the word poverty, then brutality and welfare state, and then public sector ethos and privatisation. The reason I'm saying that is it's all linked in together. I think any civilised person listening to a report like that, also listening to other things, you know, the hate crime against disabled people, you know, the fact that in this country, the sixth richest country in the world, there's people living in third world type poverty, you know, would feel ashamed. And it's an absolute indictment. But I guess, like anybody else, that the idea of that kind of brutality being directed towards children is really the most shaming thing in our society at the present time. And there's some people shake their heads and just say it's human nature. Well, it isn't. It's about the fact that we're seeing eroded on a daily basis over the course of the past 10, 12, maybe more years, the erosion of the welfare state or the basic concept of social security. Now, I think we need to have a real discussion in this country about the concept of social security, because it's been used as a dirty expression by some people. In reality, social security doesn't mean just going and getting benefits or getting a pension. It means making sure that people are living in a safe environment. It means making sure that people, particularly the most innocent and vulnerable in society, are protected. And I'll just tell you one thing. It's not a political point, because it's just the absolute truth, that there is no way that we can protect children on the basis of privatised services, the same way we can't run the health service or welfare services on the basis of privatisation.
Why not?
Because profit is the main motive. There is no ethos, there's no public sector ethos that we've built up in this country over a long period of time. That has been destroyed. And that is why, you know, it's not just a question of incompetence, that, you know, whether it be policy incompetence, as we heard there, these homes being put in areas which would make abuse more liable to happen. It's not just about financial incompetence. It's about the fact that the companies running these, I'm sure there's some good people work for them, but the main aim is to make profit, not to deal with the problems of those children.
Well, you talk about social security, which is quite an expression I quite like, actually, the idea of social security rather than sort of guns everywhere and security guards. One of the things we'll be talking about in the second half with Kevin Carhill after the news is the payments by the Common Agricultural Policy, the Duke of Buccleuch, £549,000 he gets. He's obviously got some social security, as the Duke of Westminster gets over £500,000. Prince Charles gets £581,000. The Queen gets paid over £500,000 a year. And 47 people have received more than £1 million a year as part of these common agricultural payments, just to help with their running their farms. Martin, what about Marina's report, though? Ultimately, something surely needs to be done about this. I mean, this report, the Berelowitz report, the Deputy Children's Commissioner, she's warning that children in care homes are being subjected to sexual abuse of a violent and sadistic nature, and that most victims are female.
Well, I mean, those children are some of the most vulnerable people in our society. And as I said last week, after the Baby P case, a Labour MP, who's a woman Labour MP whose name sadly I've forgotten, said and made a very pertinent point. She said that every year in Britain, 250 children are murdered by their carers. And of that 250, only 60 were previously known to social services. And there is, in fact, a very, very nasty side of Britain out there, where young vulnerable people, I mean, they're talking about withdrawing housing benefit for under 25, so we'll have them all sleeping on the streets as we did in the 80s. This is vicious, vicious stuff. And people in this country who are in uncomfortable circumstances should hang their heads in shame that this is going on.
One of the problems, of course, particularly for youngsters as well, is the looming problem of unemployment. I mean, it's very easy for us older folks to remember the days in the sort of 70s and 80s. I don't know if you go back that quite that far, John, when actually it was very easy to get a job. And in fact, the you could pick and choose. You know, you could say, well, actually, that employer's a bit of a bully. I don't think I will work with him. I don't respect him. I'm going to go and work for somebody else down the road. And you could do that in those days. That's certainly not the case now. So let's go over to Marina Morris, who's been out on the streets again this week asking about you about unemployment.
What is causing unemployment? Laziness, the government, bankers, immigration?
Crime, possibly. People being allowed benefits easily, I think, has got a big impact.
Yeah, I think it's the government, because of they let too much immigration into the country. I think that's partly the cause. Probably laziness as well. I think a lot of people are quite lazy, so...
In my opinion, it's mainly sort of lack of education and laziness. They sort of go hand in hand, where people don't realise how fun a job can be. I think it's attitude towards employment more than laziness. It's how people view employment as just doing something to get enough money to live, where actually employment is about how you spend your life and how you exist.
A mix of all of them. I'm not sure any one particular reason.
We want to go back to more labour-intensive work. Eco-economic. I don't think it's any of those, really. The government listens to the population because it's supposed to be a democracy, but the population is too stupid or too... They don't see the reasons for unemployment, which is more labour-intensive work. It's too many machines. And the machines need a lot of people with degrees and engineering qualifications. Oh, we might have to reduce the population a little bit. Because we're too many of us. Yeah. But we need to think about it, not just go blindly on creating more technology, you know, to solve our problems.
There are a lot of people in society who don't have the education so that they can actually get qualified to do certain jobs. They have the potential, probably because they've come from maybe a deprived upbringing. Maybe they think that they might not be able to achieve just like everyone else. And if you enjoy the job that you're doing, economic climate at the moment, a lot of people are losing jobs, and we need to somehow create more training opportunities and more jobs for people.
Should housing benefits be withdrawn from jobless under 25s?
I think so. I know a few people who've got housing benefits who are jobless under 25, and to be honest, it just makes them lazy and they're not trying to get a job. They're just sort of sitting there. They've got their house, they've got their dole money coming in, and they're just doing nothing. It's not pushing them to get a job, get out there. The people who haven't got parents and have absolutely nowhere to live could end up on the streets. So yeah, for them, it's an acceptance.
I'm under 25 and work full time, but I can't afford a house. It's a bit unfair, really.
I don't think so, because it's quite often at that age that you are just finding your way and you've just come out of education and you're going into possibly self-employment or into finding your job, your lifestyle, as Richard put it. And sometimes you just need that little bit of a helping hand. In fact, if anything, maybe it should be withdrawn from a different age group where they've already had the time to establish their careers or their lifestyles.
I think it shouldn't be withdrawn. I think it would be a negative effect, but maybe the way that it's presented should be differently, so it's not about giving you support when you're not doing anything. It should be more about looking towards work, and if you're becoming self-employed or something, then it should be there for you. But if you haven't had a job and aren't looking for a job, then you shouldn't be entitled to it, something along those lines.
Well, that was certainly an interesting selection of views there, picked up, I have to say, up in Castle Park at lunchtime of people who have got jobs. And obviously there is the attitude for many people, John McAnally. They see the unemployed as simply lazy, and maybe that what they need is to have their benefits taken away in order to get them to force them, really, to get work.
Well, I would like to think that the interviews that were carried out there are not fully reflective of what people in the country think, but... It's certainly true that, as I said earlier, that along with the cuts in privatisation, there's been an ideological offensive. It's the idea, the word welfare, if you looked up in a dictionary, is actually quite a nice word. It's now been almost used as a swear word, meaning that people who get benefits at all are scrounging, etc.
Well, it's now, an American word. It's an American word, actually, isn't it? I mean, that's what they used for their system over there, welfare. It's slowly come across the Atlantic, and we now use it rather than Social Security. We use that word too.
Well, funnily enough, I was just reading in a biography of Charles Dickens last night that when he visited America in 1830s, I think it was, that the word welfare and a Boston was looked upon as a good word, because it helped to build civil society in terms of protecting the most vulnerable. He describes it a very civilised place. So that's what it's about. It's what kind of society we want. There's been this campaign that's been going on by politicians, by the press, and sadly by an increasing number of academics who are putting out the great lie that the problem in society is about people who are scroungers at the bottom level of society, just living on benefits. Nobody wants to live on benefits. The fact of the matter is there's something like 5 million people unemployed in this country, and those who aren't unemployed, very many of them are working in very, very low paid jobs. Wages have been held down, not just for the last year or two because of the pay freeze, but for decades. More and more money is going to that very tiny top in society. And, you know, so from that point of view, that there has been, an offensive to try and make it socially acceptable to stamp on the heads of the most vulnerable in society. And, of course, it's had some impact. Can I just give this example? I'm not a royalist, so I did try to avoid Jubilee when it was on TV, but you can't be entirely successful. But it was funny that one of the things that I think will stick in people's memories about that Jubilee was not all the posh people in the fancy frocks and the people in their uniforms. It was the fact there was people from this city in Bristol and elsewhere were made to work for nothing. Were had to sleep under London Bridge, weren't given proper food, and if they didn't do it, they were in fear of losing benefits.
Yes, now, they weren't given proper changing facilities.
They weren't
either,
given proper
having to change in the street.
I didn't want to take up too much of your. I could go on for a long time about what they weren't given. Now you see that. I think the people in that interview, I think if you sat down and posed the question or posed the argument in a different way to them, would realise that they're really spouting out stuff from the Daily Mail. And very many of those people in that interview at some point in their life will definitely have to either claim benefit. Can I just make one last point? On the question of this attack on the unemployed and the cuts in welfare, which takes up a quarter and more of all the cuts that are already taking place, it's one of the biggest con games, because one of the groups in society that is actually worst hit by that is actually low-paid workers, with the ending of universal benefits and the ending of tax credits. It also affects what some people who would describe themselves as middle class. So when Cameron stands up and talks about scroungers, it's not that he is ignorant. He knows exactly what he's doing, and this is why I've no hesitation calling people like him nothing more than criminals for the hate that they're spreading in our society.
Martin, one chap there was saying there's too many machines around, maybe we should reduce the population.
Well, I mean, that's sort of blue skies thinking sort of stuff, isn't it? I mean, the main point I would make about is this. If you are going to pursue an austerity policy, now in actual fact I don't think we should be pursuing one, but if you are going to pursue one, the logic of it is that you get rid of lame ducks and you get your change in your economy as quickly as possible. And you know you remake the economy and it has a different kind of structure. Now if you're going to do that, the logical corollary of that is that you increase benefits so that people can be moved rapidly from work where they are currently not, you know, where the profits are not to be made, onto onto benefits, and then the benefit system creates what's called an automatic stabilizer for the economy. So you know when a factory closes in a small town, the town doesn't just disintegrate because the benefit system holds it up while it makes changes and finds new things to do. And in actual fact, what you should be doing is increasing benefits at this moment, not decreasing them, because it's had the macroeconomic effects of cutting benefits in areas like this in Eastern, for example, is that all the little shops will close. And then the people in the shops, they will go on benefits. And then your vicious spiral sets in. So all this stuff about cutting benefits is actually wrong-headed.
I noticed that Kerry McCarthy had a little piece in the Evening Post this week saying that there's over £100 million will be lost from Bristol's economy when this benefit cap kicks in.
Yes, and that means that Bristol's economy will then be that much worse off. But of course, it's taking a while for people to work out, to rumble what's going on.
I mean, you say that. Is that actually, you think there's some sort of confidence trick going on?
Well, I mean,
on
people basically are largely economically illiterate. So when they're told by Tory politicians that we've maxed out the credit card and we've got to pay the debts down, they just go, yes, yes. But of course, if you actually study economics, you'll realise that austerity is absolutely absurd. I mean, if you look at Paul Krugman and Joe Stiglitz, US economists, they're saying, look, we've got to stop this obsession with austerity. And of course, what will happen as a result of this austerity is there will be an almighty crash, and then many of the people that were interviewed there will lose their jobs.
Exactly.
And then they'll find that they do in fact need benefits.
Actually, the article I was talking about has got a nice picture of Kerry McCarthy, but it's not just her saying this. It's actually £125 million is going to be sucked out of Bristol's economy, and this is council bosses warning about this, John.
Look, I'm glad that Kerry said that, and but the fact of the matter, I will go back to this point. We can't just fight these problems on an individual basis, you know, speaking up for Bristol or for Bath or for Liverpool, for that matter. The whole cuts and privatisation programme is wrong, and I would hope Kerry and other Labour MPs will, as we began this programme, realise that if they're going to truly represent people, they have to oppose the whole of the cuts and privatisation programme in its absolute entirety. Because I agree 100% with what Martin said there about the benefit system and elsewhere. See, part of the problem is we don't have politicians going out and articulating the need for proper social security, proper benefits, proper investment in society.
But John, we need a country services. That actually produces, actually makes money. We can't have a country all on benefits.
No, I never said that. In actual fact, those countries with the strongest benefit systems, say Sweden and so on, are the ones who get people back into work quickest. There's nothing complicated. I mean, Martin expressed it extremely well there in terms of how he set it out. But there's nothing complicated about this. It's a wise investment to see somebody through a difficult time in their life in order to make sure they get back into work as soon as possible.
Now, one big story this week in Iceland, hasn't been heard about, seems most of the rest of the world, is the re-election of Icelandic President Olafur Grimsson for a record fifth term. Martin, this guy seems to be very popular, and he's just locked up a load of his bankers.
Yes, well, they've locked up the bankers. They refused to pay the British and Dutch governments for their depositors that had lost money in Landsbanki and Icesave. And the Icelandic economy is growing, unlike ours.
John, what do you think about it? Why aren't we hearing too much about what's going on in Iceland? Because it seems like they've actually got over their banking crisis there. Now, their figures, generally speaking, they're over the worst of the banking crisis there.
Well, you know, I mean, it's quite simple. The establishment doesn't want you to hear it, and there is no free press in this country. The newspapers are controlled by millionaires and billionaires. So really, there's no debate, and that is why with those people in Castle Park who, I mean, to be honest, you're probably very, very decent people. They're simply being misled. There's no real debate in this country, and that is why we need to, whether it be in the trade union movement or in the communities or whatever, we have to go out and articulate what people's fears or aspirations, etc. Yeah.
Well, okay, thanks very much, John. Time now for the Murdoch News at 6 o'clock. Well, thanks for this week's guest. You just heard there, National Vice President of the Public and Commercial Services Union, or PCS, John McAnally. After the news, well, we had insight a few weeks ago into who owns Britain. This week, it's who owns the world. We talked to Kevin Carhill, also David Powell from Friends of the Earth.
This is BCFM 93.2, the community station for Bristol. Listen live online at bcfm.org.uk.